Today, the GDP per capita conundrum. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analyst. It's one of the latest posts covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by Salvatore Babones, Associate Professor at the University of Sydney. Hello there.
Hi, and thank you for having me back on the channel. Thanks especially to your viewers, because they're the ones who must be getting sick of me by now. But I really appreciate the opportunity to reach out to people.
Well, you know, what we're trying to do here is to have a range of different views and opinions and different people to come on. And certainly the past posts that you participated in got a very good reaction. And, you know, importantly, some of the perspectives people hadn't thought about before. So, and I like to try and do that on this channel. And I guess today, Salvatore, I wanted to think about the GDP thing a bit, right? Because the numbers are out today. You know, I got a bunch of questions, like, for example, is GDP actually measuring anything useful? And why is it that there's such a gap between the GDP and the GDP per capita numbers?
Well, I'm a bigger fan of GDP than is fashionable nowadays. I think it's an incredibly useful measure, as long as we remember what it's measuring. GDP, a gross domestic product, is a measure of the economic activity going on in a country that's for pay. It does not include things that are not for pay. So there are all sorts of wonderful things people do, like housework, like caring for children, voluntary work. That's not part of GDP and should not be part of GDP, because GDP is a tool that we use for policy. You know, if you raise or lower the interest rates, as the Reserve Bank just did, that's not going to have any effect on housework or on people's willingness to volunteer. It's only going to have an effect on the money economy. And so I think it's really appropriate, really important to understand that GDP is measuring the money economy and economic activity in the money economy. And because of that, our tools are useful then for tweaking GDP and trying to have an influence on GDP.
Okay. And so it is activity, and you know, it's good activity, bad activity. So if you're making guns or if you're making selling roses, right, they both count.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's economic activity.
Yeah. If you're charging for prostitution, that's economic activity. That will be in there too.
And we can argue whether that's good or bad, but it happens, right? Yeah. And in many countries, we're even trying to measure the illegal economy, because, of course, if you buy drugs, that's going to be affected by interest rate policy. That's going to be affected by labor market policy. And, you know, you may not want the drug market to exist, but it does exist, and it's part of the economy.
Right. And so one of the limitations is it doesn't actually think about the outcomes. So, for example, you know, if you're polluting or if you're not polluting, or if people are working really, really hard and long hours or short hours, so there's nothing about quality of life. But in terms of a relatively narrow but important lens, it really has become the cornerstone of most policy these days, hasn't it?
Right, and appropriately so, because our policy tools generally affect the money economy. Our policy tools don't affect many, our economic policy tools don't affect many other worthwhile and important things that contribute to human welfare, but are not actually in the money economy. So the statistics should match up with the policy tools. And when they do, then we can see our policy hopefully having an impact.
Mm. And it's quite interesting in New Zealand, they're talking about bringing in other metrics too, particularly about sort of, you know, wellness or, you know, how people are feeling and those things as well. But again, that's not quite the same as GDP, right?
That's welfare. That's not GDP. And look, we can make this very immediate for everybody if we talk about Google, for example. Mm. Now, for most of us, in terms of welfare, Google search is fantastic because we get this free access to the internet that, you know, we think of the value of Google search is incredible to us. And economists have actually been trying to put a number on that. How much would people value access to Google search? But from a GDP standpoint, Google is not a search engine. Google is an advertising company. They're selling advertising to people, and that's where they make their money. So from a human welfare standpoint, Google's incredibly important to us for organizing the world's information. But from an economic standpoint, it's important as an advertising seller. And those two roles of Google, those two faces of Google, really distinguish between the idea of welfare and the idea of the money economy. GDP is on that money economy side. From a GDP standpoint, Google's an advertising company. It is not a search engine.
Mm. Okay, that's very helpful. It's a good example, actually. So, you know, if you look at the GDP numbers just come out today, right? The top line number was 0.5% over the quarter and just over 2.2% over the year. The GDP per capita was a lot lower. Now, I want to try and help people understand the difference between the GDP and the GDP per capita, because they're not the same, are they?
Right. Well, normally when we study economic growth, we focus on GDP. GDP per capita moves up and down with GDP, because for most countries, demographic change over the course of a quarter or a year is pretty insignificant. I mean, the labor force does shrink or grow, the total population does shrink or grow, but broadly speaking, 0.1% here or there in the size of the population isn't going to matter for how we interpret GDP statistics. But Australia is different. Immigration is so enormous in Australia that it makes a difference between a GDP growth figure of 2.2% for the year and a GDP per capita figure of only 0.7% for the year. And that's because population is growing at roughly 1.5, 1.6% per year. And all of that growth, actually, quote unquote, more than all of that growth is coming from immigration. The natural increase, rate of natural increase in Australia, I believe, is actually negative in most years, but immigration turns it over to a positive population increase. Mm. And so Australia, almost uniquely among developed countries, has this problem that GDP can't be taken at face value. Now, New Zealand, to some extent, is in the same boat, though not as much in that boat, not as deep in that boat as Australia is. Thus, it's very possible for Australia to have a per capita recession where GDP per capita declines, even though GDP is still rising. Now look at Australia's famous economic miracle. We're now talking about, 30 years of uninterrupted growth in Australia if you measure GDP. But if you put it in per capita terms, Australia has had the same recessions as everyone else. There was a recession in 1991. There was a recession in 2000. There was a recession in 2008, 2010. There was even, depending how you count it, a brief per capita recession in 2013. And again, even in 2018. 2018 had two consecutive quarters of negative GDP per capita growth, which would be a typical definition of what's a technical recession. So Australia's had all of these per capita recessions where other countries like the United States and the United Kingdom are simply recording recessions. Our statistics don't show those recessions because the population growth has been so rapid that it overwhelms the economic cycle, the ordinary business cycle, up and down in the economy, which in a normal country would be like a wave. In Australia, it's like a wave going up a hill. And as a result, sometimes you can have a slowdown without having a technical recession.
Right. And there are around 300,000 new people coming into Australia from migration every year, right? That's a big number. And what that means is that essentially more people are going into the workforce, more people are working, so effectively the pie gets bigger.
Right.
But actually the value of that pie that's being created on a individual basis, if you divide it by the number of people, is not going up as quickly.
I mean, pure GDP statistics are almost meaningless. GDP has to be related to either per capita or per worker or per hour worked. If you just look at strict GDP, then countries like China that are much poorer than Australia would appear to be much richer. Of course, in per capita terms, Australia is something like six times as rich as China. And you have to normalize GDP or standardize it to some kind of per capita basis. Now, this is something I've been writing about. I've been going on about this per capita recession idea in an article for Forbes in 2017 and Foreign Policy Magazine in 2018, Spectator in 2019. I thought I had coined the term per capita recession, and I know I'm the first person who used it with respect to Australia. Now I hear it all the time. In fact, Australia's own unconventional economist, Leif Van Onselen, is the one who coined the term, but he applied it to New Zealand. And I found out only recently he thought of the term about a year before I did, applying it in an article to New Zealand in June 2017. But, it's only Australia and New Zealand that have this phenomenon. American, British, Canadian economists would never even have thought to talk about a per capita recession because in those countries, a recession is a recession.
I think this is really interesting and really important, right? There was a paper that was published by one of the US Fed, and they said it's impossible for Australia to go into recession on a GDP basis because migration is so strong that essentially it will always be getting bigger.
Right. And I believe that was the St. Louis Fed. I'm not sure about that myself.
Yep.
The economy will always be getting bigger. And that's a recent phenomenon. You know, Australia's GDP growth, if you track it over the last 30 years, if you look at the Keating government, 2.5% annual GDP per capita growth. The Howard government, 2.4% compound annual GDP per capita growth. But then migration really kicked into high gear. Rudd-Gillard Rudd, 0.9% compound GDP per capita growth. Abbott Turnbull Morrison, 1.1 or 1.2% if you incorporate the latest figures, GDP per capita growth. Per capita GDP growth in Australia has seriously slowed down. Higher levels of migration have resulted in a sharing out of the economic activity on this continent among a larger number of people. And that has acted on as a drag on growth.
Right. And that also explains one of the reasons why wages growth is relatively weak too, right? Because basically you've got more people flooding into the market who are happy to work, and therefore the pay rates don't need to go up.
Well, unions used to be thoroughly anti-immigration. And the reason they were, both in the United States and in Australia, was the simple fact that more people competing for the same number of jobs means lower wages. Now, in Australia, there's, of course, that's supposed to be balanced by the skilled migration stream. The idea that people are only let in if they have strategic skills that are needed for the country. Now, I doubt that Australia needs quite as many accountants as are admitted in the skilled migration stream, never mind the hairdressers, you know. But the problem is that most skilled migrants are not even working in their nominated professions. A survey by the University of South Australia found that only 44% of skilled migrants were working in the professions they nominated on the skilled migrant form. So they're being admitted for a skill they have and they've certified, but that's not what they're actually doing with their work. It's even worse for their partners, for their family members. So if you look at the data on who's working and how much, among skilled migrants, of course, you have to have good job prospects to get in. Skilled migrants have 83% labor force participation. And among those people who are in the labor force, only 6.7% unemployed. Their family members who come in with them, spouses and adult children, have only a 64% labor force participation, and 10.2% of them are unemployed, which means if you want to ask how many of their family members, adult family members, are employed, it's only a little over 50%. Now, that's dragging down per capita GDP because more people are coming into the country who are unemployed or unemployable. I mean, the humanitarian stream is even worse. It's only a small number of migrants, but fewer than half are in the labor force. And among those who are in the labor force, 20% are unemployed. So for the humanitarian stream, only about 40% or less of humanitarian immigrants, refugees, are actually employed.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting. And, you know, there's a lot of important detail there that people probably weren't aware of. What does this mean, though, for productivity?
Well, first, it's bad and it's going to get worse. It drives down productivity because people are not working in the jobs for which they have skills. So that means presumably they're working at a lower level of productivity than they otherwise would. It also means that the economy as a whole is increasing its proportion of low-skilled jobs. That is, people are coming in who either don't have skills or aren't able to use their skills, and so they're flooding into the low-skilled job market. As a result, Australia doesn't automate at the same rate that, say, the United States does, because there's no need to automate jobs if you have a large pool of migrants who are willing to take the jobs that would otherwise have been automated out of existence. On top of that, it's going to get worse because Australia's migration profile right now is very young. You know, people who are targeted for skills migration tend to be very young. People on student visas are very young. Over time, this is going to shift because inevitably in a democracy, you have to let grandma in. Right? You have to let, you know, you can't tell people, we'd like to have you in Australia, but not your parents, not your grandparents. I mean, once someone's here, and especially once they're a citizen, they want to family members, and legitimately so. But those family members are even less likely to work. So over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you know, I'm not an economist, I'm a sociologist. Don't ask me about growth next quarter. Ask me about growth in 2040 and beyond. At that point, Australia's migration profile will not be dominated by young skills stream migrants. by the 2040s, 2050s, Australia's migration profile will be dominated by family reunification immigration, which right now is less than a third of immigration. But over the next 20, 30, 40 years, it's inevitably going to make up a larger and larger percentage of Australia's immigration.
Right, but that has a really interesting implication then on demographic shifts, right? Because we already know that we've got a significant skew towards older age groups, you know, and in fact, the proportion of people not working versus working is going up. So what you're saying is that the migration strategy is actually going to work against us as well.
Well, the migration strategy has been a temporary boon to Australia. Temporarily, through the 2000s and the 2010s, Australia has had a younger labor force profile than it would otherwise have. But that can't be sustained forever unless Australia just wants to have population grow at a hugely exponential rate and have 200 million people by the end of this century. But assuming that migration will continue to level off and, you know, moderate its pace, the composition of migration will turn against Australia in the coming decades. Now, on top of that, there's the infrastructure issue. So Australia's productivity has been boosted the last 20 years by the fact that Sydney and Melbourne have had a fixed amount of infrastructure, you know, roads, street lights, rail infrastructure, but have packed more and more people into that limited infrastructure. You know, when was the last time Sydney built a dam to increase its water supply? I think that was quite a while ago, 60 years ago, something like that, with Australia, Sydney's last dam. Well, now it's reaching the limits of that growth. So over the next 20 or 30 years, Sydney and Melbourne especially, but also Brisbane, will have to invest heavily in infrastructure, which will further reduce per person productivity because more and more investment will be required in order to keep pace with the demographic growth. We've reached the limits. I mean, everyone living in Sydney knows we've reached the limits of growth on our existing infrastructure. Suddenly, it's going to get much more expensive to increase population levels.
Right. So does that mean that we should be thinking about throttling back migration then? Is that the right strategy?
Well, better to have not done it in the first place and have a moderate level of immigration. And I say that as an immigrant to Australia. Now that it's done, there should be an intentional moderation. Australia should be dialing down the numbers cautiously instead of letting them continue to boom out of control. Now, there has been a slight dialing down, but I want to remind Australians that even with the current reduced levels of immigration, and when I say current, I mean reduced compared to 2016 to 2018, Australia still is the most immigrant developed country in the entire world. Australia is pushing about 30% foreign born. That compares to New Zealand is in the mid 20s. Canada is down around 20%. The US currently is at its most immigrant since 1890, and the United States is only at 16% foreign born. Australia is pushing 30, maybe actually over 30% at this point. So Australia today is twice as immigrant as the United States has ever been in all of its history. Dialing back immigration in those circumstances is not some kind of small Australia or white Australia approach. That's just good sense. I mean, Australia is busting at the seams with its levels of immigration today. It needs moderation.
Well, that's really interesting, and that goes counter to what many people, I think, would probably think is good. So fascinating insights from you there, Salvatore. Appreciate your time today, and I reckon we'll be catching up again quite soon.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that.